This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
I handed out these, we passed out these booklets so that you can see three different versions of the Heart Sutra on page 5, 6, 5, 6, and 22. And then on page 2, we have this, it says, before Dharma talk. So we can all recite that together. Okay. And unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to, remember and accept, I am bound to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Well, this is a very grandiose introduction. 100,000 million kalpas. And then the truth of the Tathagata's words. Tathagata means thus come, or the one who has thus come. And typically it refers to the Buddha. That was a sort of nickname, I guess you could say, that was given him. But it refers to thus come. And so we understand come, and what does thus mean in this case? Thus come. It must be something very special. But what is this thus? So, does anyone have an idea about what thus means in this case?
That does come like a ripening. It's just the way it's flowing. It does come. It comes. So in becoming, it naturally does, not forced or anything.
Kind of natural ripening. Okay, any other?
Just now?
Now? Come now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it certainly expands beyond the Buddha to our ripening experience of the moment. In a sense, we are all thus come, I think we could say. So we can taste the truth of our words, since we are all thus come. At the end of the talk, then we'll do this chant after the Dharma talk. Well, the reason I'm talking today is because we just had a calligraphy workshop Friday evening and yesterday, and this is these are one of the results, and
This is the other one. Everybody who participated except for one put a character on here. So these are all by each participant. And so the words are these words. You can see the translation of each of them. This is, if you look at in your Heart Sutra at page five. In the third line, perceived that all five skandhas are empty and was saved from all suffering and distress. So this is Avalokiteshvara, who is a bodhisattva and sort of the speaker of this sutra. And Avalokiteshvara is a sort of a bodhisattva, was apparently not a real person, but a being who developed in people's minds and understanding as an ideal expression of Buddhist insight. And consequently, Avalokiteshvara in different areas was either masculine or feminine in practice. We all have heard of Guanyin or Kannon. And Guanyin became feminine in China, and either masculine or feminine, both in Japan. So Avalokiteshvara is the subject of this first part. So Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, perceived that all five skandhas are empty and was saved from all suffering and distress. So with this perception that all five skandhas are empty, Avalokiteshvara was saved from suffering and distress. And then if you look at the on page six, Avalokiteshvara, who helps all to awaken. So instead of saying bodhisattva, it's the translation of bodhisattva, who helps all to awaken, moves in the deep course of realizing wisdom beyond wisdom. The wisdom beyond wisdom is the Prajnaparamita. So when practicing deeply, the Prajnaparamita is translated here as moves in the deep course of realizing wisdom beyond wisdom. And then the third line sees that all five streams of body and mind. So it's present tense, whereas in the on page five it's a past tense, a finished event. So on page six it's a present event, constantly happening. So sees that all five streams of body and mind are boundless and frees all from anguish. So frees all. So by this insight, then Avalokiteshvara frees everyone from suffering, from anguish. Whereas on page five, it's understood as Avalokiteshvara was saved from all suffering and distress. So it's Avalokiteshvara's own salvation experience, so to speak. So it's a very different kind of translation in a way, because on page 6, the freeing means that everyone was freed. If you look at page 22, Avalokiteshvara, when practicing deeply with the insight that brings us to the other shore. So insight that brings us to the other shore is the Prajnaparamita, or wisdom beyond wisdom. Suddenly discovered that all of the five skandhas are equally empty. And with this realization, he overcame all ill being. So here, he overcame all ill being. It could be in either sense that he himself overcame ill being, or he overcame ill being for everyone. So this translation business is really tricky, and it's not simplified too much, because they are working from a couple of Sanskrit versions and three or four Chinese versions, all of which have slight differences. So you can kind of pick and choose a little bit when you're translating. It's a really interesting process, I'm sure, trying to do this. So this phrase which we have written here is simply all. This all refers to all the skandhas, and are empty. So all the skandhas are empty or boundless. So that's a whole life study, in a sense, is what is the way to translate this this word empty or boundless, or how do you understand it? So then after empty, we have relieve. and then we have isai here, means all at once or entirely. One cut. The best example is when you see a samurai film, and the samurai holds his sword up, and his enemy is there, and he just slashes the enemy's head off, all in one slice. You know, it's complete, entire. So one cut, entirely. So relieve entirely the suffering. This is bitterness, and this is pain, something like that. So in the calligraphy class, we talked a little bit about these characters. This is the earlier form called seal script, and this is the sort of basic form that everyone can read. And this is said to be a row of people talking. This is a mouth with a tongue. So it means everyone all together talking. Here we have this is basically a roof. This bell-shaped form is a roof. And then within it, there's some separation or opening. And then here, this implies work or more being done. So we can understand it as the opening becomes larger and larger. And then this character came to mean sky. See, it was initially like opening a cave or opening the space under a roof, because this is a roof. And then gradually it was opened, and then more opening, so it becomes sky or just space or empty. Even though it seems to be filled, there it is, empty. This character for relieve has several different interpretations, but the simplest one is to see this as 10 and 10 is 20, meaning many or all, in under a roof, under a house, and being helped, someone with their hand is helping them, so giving relief. Sometimes these explanations are just useful in order to remember what the different elements are in the character. It's not necessarily historically accurate. This is number one. You can see pretty elaborate in one of the early forms. Number one is just one basic line. And then here, cut is this. This is a sword or a knife, and this is 10, so a lot of cuts. And then bitter is this is a plant, just a fresh plant growing, and then it's 10, and mouth supposedly means 10 generations. Or 10 iterations of something, so that means old. And so when a plant gets old, it gets bitter. Mm-hmm. So that seems reasonable. And this one is another confusing one. There are several different explanations, but the most useful one is that this is a cliff, and this is a person with it bent over, or in other words, suffering in pain at the bottom of a cliff. So, and the modern form, the regular form is like this. And then all of this is about regarding the five skandhas. This is five skandhas. We didn't practice these. Since skanda is a pretty complicated character, and we only had so much time. But anyway, all of this is in reference to the five skandhas. And the word skanda is prominent in Buddhism, but I don't know that it's very, very well. What would you say? I think it's hard to work with the word skanda, but there are different understandings of skanda. Apparently, when the Buddha used the word skanda, he was referring to the trunk of the what is the tree that Bodhi tree? You know, that it has trunk, but then it has branches, and then it has many roots going down. And so it makes a whole lot of roots. So it becomes its own little forest sometimes. So it was referring to that kind of trunk or root or something, so that vertical thing. And those were skandhas. So it's been translated as trunks, as pillars, or piles, or layers, and even as streams. And in the sutra on page 6, it uses streams. It sees that all five streams of body and mind are boundless. So I think, for me, that's the most helpful translation of skanda, because our body or form and our sensations and our mental activities, perception, memory and consciousness, those things are all constantly flowing. They're not just sitting there in a static condition. So considering that the various aspects of our sense of self are understood as streams seems to me to be pretty useful, especially in this religion which celebrates change all the time, or suffers from change, deals with change. So using the word streams seems pretty useful. So these five skandhas are everything which is needed for spiritual explorations, or they're everything that we think of when we think of self. But they are also equivalent to our understanding of the universe as we experience it. So in some ways we could understand this whole sutra as an explication of this experience of Avalokiteshvara in realizing wisdom beyond wisdom, practicing wisdom beyond wisdom. And in that he saw that all of the elements of ourselves are streams which are boundless, or which are empty. The word empty, of course, is always problematic, because it sounds so, in a way it sounds so static. If something is empty, there's absolutely nothing there, and that's it. But if we say boundless, we can at least understand that there's no, it can just go on and on. And the profound sense of the interconnectedness of things is very evident. And however we understand things, which also are streams or are changing elements, they're just instances of change. So we can end up by experiencing all of this we would be practicing the realizing wisdom beyond wisdom, or wisdom which reaches the other shore, or various understandings of Prajnaparamita. Another version of this phrase, or this experience of Avalokiteshvara, it was expressed as Avalokiteshvara was experiencing the insubstantiality and transparency of the five constituents of personal and communal awareness. That's the five skandhas. The five constituents of personal and communal awareness, including material forms and conscious states. Now, the way that anyone in the Buddhist tradition practices the Prajnaparamita, or opens oneself to the Prajnaparamita, is by the sixfold practice of the paramitas. And The really important thing for me about the whole Buddhist tradition is that it's basically a sharing of various people's experiences. So rather than somebody having a profound revelation, and then that revelation is communicated to us, and then we are geared to believe it and follow its teachings and so on. Rather than that, this whole practice is dependent or rises from people's experience, which they share then with other people. And then that sharing is not is not sharing a truth which you must believe. It's sharing an experience which you are encouraged to also perhaps experience, or to something which will sustain you or support you as you struggle on your path. So I think that's really a profound difference between the revelatory religion, the religions which express a divine revelation which everyone must accept. And here, it's really a grand sharing that all of these various practitioners have done and written down their experience. And somehow it's then been sort of brought together by people who are more scholarly, and those in areas in which there has been convergence of experience, and there are some certain ideas which have become very useful, we can say. So rather than doctrine, I think the word doctrine is not so helpful in Buddhism, or even orthodoxy is not a good word, because we are wanting to be constantly open to what is happening now, basically. And how can we be open to what's happening now if we are only understanding it in terms of an already preconceived and formulated insight or revelation? So that's there was a, I think it was Red Pine who said, came up with the idea that whereas in the West we have the famous formulation that I think, therefore I am, by Descartes. In the Buddhist tradition, one could say, I am aware, therefore I neither am nor am not. So what does this am notness mean, this emptiness? Emptiness or boundlessness. Let's see this. We can start with Ta-Nehisi's comment. He says, the doctrine of zeroness. Well, this is already problematic. Asserting the lack of self-identity and the lack of absolute separation in all things became the central teaching of Mahayana Buddhism. In zero-ness, all things are connected. Nothing is absolute. Nothing is separate. Nobody is alone. Even Buddhist doctrines are seen as zeroness, not containing absolute fixed truths. So the word doctrine just doesn't fit, because the doctrine is fixed, it seems to me. And anyway, he's recognizing that, not containing absolute fixed truths. Experience of this teaching is seen as awakening, as freedom no other than Prajnaparamita. So that's the key word, I think, experience of this teaching. So you can hear a teaching for years and never understand it, and then, and I think many people do take some of these teachings as doctrines, because we hear the idea of no self. I don't really exist, so therefore, all kinds of sort of arguments you can make for because you have this conclusive truth in mind. But I think saying that I have no self or I am no self is it sounds very doctrinal, like a fixed idea, and it's really very fixed. I mean, even the idea of a self is also very fixed. I mean, we all think we exist, obviously, and that's how we function. And I was trying to even just to change my mind a little bit, and instead of saying I, like I think this and that, how about using this thinks this, and this would like to take a walk now, and this is so and so and so and so. If you say this rather than I, there's a little bit of leakage away from just this fixed I, because it tends to include some of your environment. Like, this is getting hungry now. Probably sort of is true for more than just this. So it's a real struggle to get out of our sense of self. We can hear the ideas that all the elements of ourself is streaming. They're all streaming and so on. But what is this sense of? I think even the term sense of self is very useful. Instead of saying myself, say my sense of self. It loosens that hard nut of self a little bit. So does anyone have some experience of of the flowing nature or the selflessness happening once in a while?
So, okay, first of all, when I saw the character empty, it gave me understanding like nothing to grab or, you know, like free for, or, you know. But today, I have a new perception of boundless. I really appreciate the new word, boundless, mm-hmm. meaning unlimited. So, meaning all my senses are, my feelings are unlimited. My body cells are transforming every second. It's unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
My energy is unlimited. Wisdom beyond wisdom. It's unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I feel when you're talking about this idea of remove myself, like I'm not myself. Who am I? So in the past, I think I'm kind of like memorizing this sentence, like kind of treated as a fixed idea.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, I must remember it, or I must somehow live or be alive all of it. But today I feel I don't need to struggle all that. I mean, if I experience it, if I can do that, that's great. And if not yet, I accept it.
Sounds like a good step. Good, thank you.
Thank you so much.
The empty boundless got me. It seems so paradoxical, especially when we're focusing on the senses or the five elements or the streams, mm-hmm. saying, well, there they are, our senses. But when you expand the senses, they become bigger, and then you're touching the intimate. What came up is the idea of not luxuriating or savoring, but with senses, like when you look out over the ocean or the stars, you're using your eyes to see. So it's a flooding of beautiful sensory experience. Or rather than singing, when you go into worship, you lose your sense of self, but it's singing. Or maybe when like making love or something, you're in the sense and then it's activated, but then it becomes so much bigger when you see out that all of a sudden there's this emptiness or boundlessness, which is awe-inducing in a way. It's very powerful. But it's not by restricting the senses. It seems like you're just flowing in them, and then all of a sudden there's this big, like looking out over a redwood forest or this, well, any of those type of experiences where people go, wow.
Oh, yeah.
And there's the expansion or the boundlessness.
Mm-hmm.
Or the oneness.
And then very often they say, oh, I want to take a picture of that or something. And then it
capture
all
becomes... it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
What you were talking about were verbs. Making love. What was the other one?
Singing into worship,
singing,
or looking out over to
singing,
the ocean.
And the ideas that are going through my head right now are to do with verbs versus nouns. And I remember I did a paper once a long time ago about it involved the Hopi language, I think, where there's mostly verbs and not nouns. And so they just don't have this idea of fixed objects. Mm-hmm. And so there's not like there's a man, but it's manning. Or I don't, we can do it, you know, but manning is happening here, and treeing is happening over there, and it's all events. And that for me is a sort of a key idea, that events are unfolding. This is an event unfolding. There's events unfolding all over the place, you know, here among us. And then there's nothing fixed, because events are not fixed things. They're things that are going on. And so that's always been helpful for me.
Mm. Good, thank you. Any comments from the outer world? Anyone else here have a contribution from yourself or your non-self? Good. Well, I think we've had enough verbiage. Let's see if there's anything else. Oh, I noted down, it's always nice for people to understand that Avalokiteshvara, who is the Bodhisattva who gave this Heart Sutra, it's rather interesting that this the sutra is in, as I mentioned, in several different forms. And the conclusion of scholars is that the Tibetan version, which is longer, has more of a framework for the whole sutra, but that was added later, and it includes the Buddha himself sitting there in deep concentration. So the assumption is that this was done so that the sutra would have more gravitas, or would seem more genuine, because the Buddha himself was actually there. So the Tibetan version begins, well, not the very beginning, but before the versions that we have here, before they start, this version says, "At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in deep concentration." Bhagavan is the Buddha. "Deep concentration on the expression of the Dharma known as the profound illumination. And at that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, the noble Avalokiteshvara, looked at the activities of the profound perfection of wisdom," that's Prajnaparamita, "and saw that the five aggregates were devoid of self-nature." And here it doesn't say, "and was saved from all suffering and distress." "Then, by the power of the Buddha, the elder Sariputra spoke to the Bodhisattva, the noble Avalokiteshvara, 'How should a noble son or noble daughter train who wishes to engage in the profound activities of the perfection of wisdom?' The Bodhisattva, the noble Avalokiteshvara, said these words, 'O Shariputra, a noble son or daughter who wishes to engage in the profound activities of the perfection of wisdom should consider thusly and should regard the five aggregates as devoid of self-nature.'" And then he goes on to say, "Form is empty, emptiness is form," and so on, as we have in the other versions. So that gives a little more of a framework and gravitas to this sutra, which obviously was written much a long time after the Buddha had lived. And the term Avalokiteshvara, this name, it's broken down in this from the Sanskrit. Ava means down, lok means to look, ita makes it into a noun instead of a verb. And Ishvara, Lord or Master. So it's the master or the person, master of looking down. And then this Ishvara sometimes is slightly shifted to Asvara or Arsvara. And those words mean a low voice or a crying sound. So then instead of just the master of looking down, it's the master who looks or who sees the cries of the world. That's a common translation for Guanyin or Kanun, one who sees or hears the cries of the world. All right, so let's look at page 2. We have after the Dharma talk. may our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of this way. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are endless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. Okay, let's then return all the cushions to their places, and someone will collect the books, and we'll go up to the community building for.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.